Appreciate the opportunity tonight to stand before you. I've got a little bit of mixed emotions. It's been about 2 years since I've stood in front of a crowd and preached a lesson, so I've got a little bit of the nervousness that's there, but I'm quite excited. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to preach again and to get a lesson together and present a lesson. And my hope is always that when I present something, as I'm sure Andre and Doug and others that present lessons, hope that you can get something from it. I'm sure I'll probably get a whole lot more from it in being the one who prepared it, but I sure hope that in presenting it in hopefully a very simple way, that you can get something from it also. I was also a little nervous in the fact that I had to follow Andre, and I know how good of a preacher he is, so that made me a little nervous too, and I think we were talking about that both ways. We didn't want to follow the other, but I'm going to follow Andre and try to do the best I can. I've heard he did a great job this morning. So I'm going to do a lesson that is actually kind of an introduction into the book of Ezra. But the interesting thing about that is we're not going to look at any verses in Ezra. The book of Ezra, if you're at all familiar with that book, is a book of history, which a lot of times kind of scares people off. You start getting into history and everybody's kind of like, I don't know about that. It's a lot of names and dates and events. But history has always been one of my favorite things. And the book of Ezra is definitely a book of history of God's people, but it's about a specific time in the history of God's people that I think is interesting. The book of Ezra is a time period in which God's people find themselves not enjoying Canaan, not enjoying the promised land and all the great things that came with the promised land that God had promised them, and all the great blessings that were found there. The book of Ezra is about God's people when they were in captivity. They were in bondage to another nation. They weren't living in their homeland anymore. And that's what the book of Ezra is all about. You know, anytime I'm studying the Old Testament especially, I'm reminded of the importance of the Old Testament. There's many passages that we can look at, but a few, Romans 15:4, and I'm just going to go through these very quickly, but they show us the importance of studies such as this as we look at the Old Testament. In Romans 15 and in verse 4, Paul writes, "For whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we through the patience and the comfort of the Scriptures might have hope." You know, it's a very interesting thing that Paul is pointing out there, that the Old Testament, the Old Law, those things in history are so vitally important to us for our learning. See, we can look back at the people of God when they were in the land of Canaan. We can look back at the people of God when they were in bondage. And you know what we can gain from that? We can learn something. And we can gain, as Paul says here, that we might have hope. You know, we're going to learn some, I think, very valuable lessons about the idea of captivity that I hope will give us exactly that hope. In 1 Corinthians 10 and in verse 11, Paul writes, "Now these things," and if you'll notice the verses in front of that, they're all negative things. Paul's pointing out all the negative things that the children of Israel did. He said, "Now these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, our learning, upon whom the end of the ages have come." In Galatians 3 and in verse 24, Paul says, "Therefore the law was our tutor." It was something that was to teach us, instruct us. We know what a tutor is. It's a teacher. Paul says, "The law was our tutor," and here's the importance of all of that, that gives us hope, that helps us to learn, that brings us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. That's what Paul said in a number of different letters to a number of different people, saying, you know how important the old law is and the example of those people before us? It's vitally important for us to understand and to learn about God and about what He thinks about His people and how He treats His people and what He wants for His people and the hope that's found there in Christ. That's the importance of the old law and that history that sometimes we look at and think, oh, that's boring. Who wants to read through Leviticus and look at all those kinds of laws? And, well, you know it's important. Every last bit of it is important because it brings us forward to Christ. That's what it was all about. It was bringing people to Christ. So tonight we're going to be talking a little bit about the Old Testament. And specifically about God's people at the time of Ezra, who were in captivity. And I hope this will be something that is beneficial for you. Turn over to 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles, chapter 36. 2 Chronicles, chapter 36, starting in verse 11. This just gives us a little bit of history of why we find God's people as we open the book of Ezra, which you'll notice 2 Chronicles is followed by Ezra. This couple of passages that we're going to read here, these couple of verses at the end of 2 Chronicles, are going to let us see why we find God's people where we find them in the book of Ezra in captivity. Look at starting in verse 11 of 2 Chronicles chapter 36. It says, Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king. So here's one of the last king of God's people. It says he was 21 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord his God, and did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, who spoke from the mouth of the Lord. You know, we see that time and time again. The northern kingdom had already gone into Assyrian captivity. And now we've got Judah, Jerusalem, and they're about to. And we kind of see why. Well, look at their last king, Zedekiah. He was an evil king, a wicked king. Jeremiah and other prophets were sent to these people, to the kings, to try to help them see, you need to turn back to God. You need to turn back to God. And what does it say here? It says, and he did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, who spoke from the mouth of God. And he also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar. This was the king of Babylon, who had made him swear an oath by God, and he had stiffened his neck and hardened his heart against turning to the Lord God of Israel. Moreover, all the leaders of the priests and the people transgressed more and more, according to all the abominations of the nations, and defiled the house of the Lord which he had consecrated in Jerusalem. And you see the trickle-down effect. Here you have the king, Zedekiah, and what's he doing? He's not listening to the prophets. He's not listening to what God has to say. He's turning his back on them. It says here he even stiffened his neck against Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, he's standing up against everybody. He doesn't care what anybody says. He's going to do what he wants to do. And this was their leader. And you notice what it says, that Zedekiah turned from God. Zedekiah rebelled against God. And moreover, in verse 14, what else happened? The leaders, the priests, what'd they do? They did the exact same thing. They followed Zedekiah's lead. And they rebelled against God. They turned from the Lord and the teachings of the prophets that they were hearing. And notice down in verse 15 also. It's very sad to read some of these verses. And the Lord God of their fathers sent warnings to them by his messengers, rising up early and sending them because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. You know, that tells us a lot. That verse right there tells us a lot about God. Here's a people that they're turning from God left and right. Their leaders are turning from God. And what's he doing? He's sending people to them. He's sending messengers to them. He's trying to get them to turn back. He's showing compassion. You notice there it describes? That's one of the huge characteristics of God that we can't forget. Compassion on a wicked people, a rebellious people. What's God have? He has compassion on them. He wants them to turn back. Even though they've gone so far away from him, he has compassion on them. Notice verse 16. But they mocked the messengers of God. They despised his words and scoffed at his prophets until the wrath of God arose against his people. And notice that this is a very troubling passage. You see what their response was to all the things God was trying to do. He was trying to turn them back. He was sending prophets to them, messengers to them with a message of hope and of compassion. And it says, the wrath of the Lord rose against his people till there was no remedy. That's how far they had gotten. They had turned so far from God that God couldn't do anything for them. There wasn't anything else he could do. because they weren't going to listen. They weren't going to turn back. He did everything he could till there was no remedy. Notice in verse 17 what was going to happen now. Therefore he brought against them the king of the Chaldeans, that's Nebuchadnezzar that they talked about just a minute ago, who killed their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary. And notice the description of Nebuchadnezzar. I think this is important, and I think there's a reason why it's described this way. We have a God who has a rebellious people, and what's he have for them? Compassion. But they rebel, so God brings Nebuchadnezzar now, the king of the Babylonians. And notice the description of him. He killed all the young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary and had no compassion on them. He didn't care. Jehovah did, even though they were turning from him left and right, not listening to any of the voices that God was sending to them. God had compassion, but Nebuchadnezzar didn't. On the young men or virgin or on the aged and the weak, he gave them all into his hand. And all the articles from the house of God, great and small, the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king and of his leaders, all these he took to Babylon. And then they burned the house of God. And they broke down the wall of Jerusalem. And they burned all its palaces with fire and destroyed all its precious possessions. And those who escaped from the sword he carried away to Babylon, where they became servants to him and his sons until the rule of the king of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbath. As long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. What a sad, sad commentary on God's people. And even sadder than the fact that God's house, this shows you exactly how far they had come, how far they had gone and drifted away and rebelled, that even the house of God was completely destroyed. That's where God dwelled, with his people, giving them compassion and blessing them beyond anything they could imagine. And what did they do? They turned from that, and God destroyed it all and took them into captivity. He sent them into captivity. I think there are some huge, huge lessons for us. We're looking here at God's people a long time ago. But there are some tremendous lessons for us when we think about captivity. And why? Why captivity? We're going to look at that a little bit this evening. Turn over to Judges chapter 2. Judges chapter 2. This is really before there was a kingdom of God's people, but this is a time when they had come out of Egyptian bondage. They were being led to the land of Canaan, and they were taking over that land and living among the people. Notice in verse 7 of Judges chapter 2, we're gonna answer that question, why captivity? How did they find themselves there as we look at the whole history of God's people up to the point of Ezra? What brought them to the captivity? That's what we want to think about tonight. Look at Judges chapter 2 and in verse 7. I think this is one of the first things that we'll find. It says, so the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua. You know, you got a good leader. You got a man who follows God, who wants to please God, and what's going to happen? So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. Here you got a people and leaders who saw what God did for them. And they served him. They served him. All through the life of Joshua, and all through the life of those who were close to Joshua, who outlived Joshua, but were still the leaders. They served God. In verse 8, now Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old. And they buried him within the border of the inheritance of Timnath-Heres in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gaash. When all that generation, okay, so now we're moving forward a little bit. Joshua was a great leader, and the ones that came after him and lived during his time were great leaders, and they served God. And when all that generation had gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them, who did not know the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel. So now we've got something different. During the days of Joshua and the ones who lived near Joshua, people were serving God. They were trying to do what was pleasing for in the eyes of God, as Joshua did and those great leaders. And then a generation passes, and you find the people who forgot God. And it tells us there that they had forgotten all the works which he had done for Israel, or the work that he had done for Israel. And can you imagine that? Can you imagine coming up upon some young folks in the children of Israel and saying, "Boy, you remember that time when we were led out of Egypt? You remember that? God brought those plagues upon the Egyptians, and Pharaoh finally said, well, go on, get out of here. Go ahead and go. And Moses led them out of Israel, or out of Egypt. You remember that? Man, that was something. God did those works for us." And you imagine those young people saying, "What? What are you talking about? Egypt, I don't have a clue. What?" Or you remember when we finally got out of Egypt and we came to the Red Sea and we're trying to figure out how are we going to get across this. And now the Egyptian army's coming and God tells Moses, "You put your staff in the water," and it just parted. And they went across on dry land. You remember that? That was great. That was amazing. Phenomenal. And they're like, "Well, I hadn't heard of that. You know, what are you talking about?" Or how he provided for them in the wilderness. You remember we had to wander around for 40 years in the wilderness, and, you know, there's not much food out there for million plus people. And, you know, there was quail and manna every day. We had food and water, and, you know, you remember the good times. You know, we were wandering, but we were being taken care of. Got no clue what you're talking about. No idea. Now we get to the land of Canaan, and our enemies just dropped. We defeated everybody. Wiped them out. We took the land. It was great. You know, everything that we needed was there. We didn't have to build anything. We didn't have to plan anything. It was all provided for us. And we defeated all those enemies of our people. Still don't know what you're talking about. No idea. There arose a generation who did not know the Lord, nor the work that he had done for Israel. Can you imagine? In a generation's time, they had forgotten all that. Does it sound familiar? You ever find yourself there? Forgetting what God's done for you. You ever there? One day you're just driving down the road and doing what you always do, not really thinking about God and what he's done for you. You ever been there? That's where God's people were at. Didn't take very long for them to get there either. Why captivity? These were God's people. Why was God allowing Nebuchadnezzar to come in and destroy everything and take them into captivity? Because they forgot about God. They forgot about the work that he had done. It wasn't like he had just given them stuff and not really paid attention to them or anything. They forgot about all the work that God had done. I don't understand how they could forget that. But they did. They put that away from their minds. They didn't contemplate and think about that anymore. They went into captivity. What's the importance of remembering what God does for us? Look over in John 5 and in verse 36. John 5 and in verse 36. Notice what John has to say here about Jesus. He's speaking about Jesus. Actually, Jesus is speaking here. John's recording it for us. In John 5 and in verse 36, he says, "But I have a greater witness than John's." You know, Jesus here is speaking about what is it that lets people know that I am who I say I am. Well, one of the things was John. John the Baptist was going out telling everybody, "Here's the Lamb of God. This is the Son of God. And I'm here to prepare the way for him. You need to hear him. You need to listen to him." And Jesus says, well, one of the things that bears witness of me is John. But there's something greater than John. For the works which the Father has given me to finish, the very works that I do, bear witness of me that the Father has sent me. What's Jesus saying here? If you got any doubt in your mind of who I claim to be, I'm the Son of God. If you have any doubt in your mind, let me do something for you. Let me show you something. John's been telling you, and you should believe him. But let me do something for you. Let me show you something if you don't believe me. That's what Jesus is saying. I can do some things and show you some things that will show you, will be a witness to you that I am who I claim to be. You know, God's always shown us. He doesn't just tell us, I'm God, I'm the Creator. You're supposed to just believe that without any kind of proof or evidence or anything. God gives us all kinds of work, all kinds of evidence to prove who He claims to be. And that's what Jesus is saying. If you don't believe me, let me show you some things. And maybe that'll help you. That's how important the works that Jesus did were. They were to prove who He was, that He came from God, that He was the Son of God, that He was exactly who He claimed to be. I mean, God's people, you know what they did? They forgot all that. They forgot all the things that God was trying to show them to prove who He was and what He was telling them was true. That all the promises that He made would come to be. They forgot all that. And they went into captivity. Look at Judges chapter 21. Judges chapter 21. It's the very last verse of the book of Judges. Speaks volumes about God's people. Judges 21. And in verse 25, the very last verse of that book. Judges 21 and in verse 25. Two very important things in this verse, but notice the first. In those days, there was no king in Israel. All right? They had judges. Hadn't got to the point of a king yet. But that also tells us something else. Who was the king? They did have a king. But the writer of Judges says there was no king in Israel. Shame on them. Shame on them. And since there was no king in Israel, guess what they did? They did whatever they wanted to do. And everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So first, they forgot God and everything He had done for them. And second, they just did whatever they wanted. They did what was right in their own eyes. Now, what's the problem with that? What's the difficulty in all that? If everyone here just decided, you know what, tomorrow, I'm just going to do what I think is right. You know, I don't know how many people we have in here, 50, 60 people. You know, what's that mean? That means we got 50 or 60 different ways of doing whatever you think is right. You know, a little bit of confusion, a little bit of chaos. And, you know, I can't tell someone else, hey, I'm doing it this way and it's right, so you need to do it that way too. No. They get to do it the way they want to do it. That's what Israel did. Everybody did what was right in their own eyes. And what's the problem with that? Well, the Proverb writer tells us in Proverbs 14 and in verse 12, you all know this verse, Proverbs 14 and verse 12, there is a way that seems right to a man. Every single one of us can think of something and think, well, this is right. I know this is right. There's a way that seems right to a man. Yeah, it looks good, looks right, looks true. That's the way to do it. There's a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. Hold on a second here. What's the proverb writer trying to tell us? Well, if we all decide to do what is right in our own eyes, watch out. Watch out. And what the proverb writer is telling us, if it's not God's way, in so many ways, this is what he's telling us. If it's not God's way, guess what? It's the wrong way. But where do we find God's people? They forgot about God. They forgot about His work. And what did they do? They did whatever was right in their own eyes. And what happened to them? They went in. There's a lesson there for us. There's a lesson there for us when we think about captivity. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 8. We start jumping a little bit further ahead now. We've gone through the Judges period, and we're coming to the kind of the close of the Judges period with the man Samuel. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 8 and in verse 5. 1 Samuel 8 and in verse 5. Actually, go up to verse 4 to kind of get the whole idea there. 1 Samuel 8 and in verse 4, then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. So Samuel's the last judge. He's the last real leader of God's people. And they're coming to him, as they should. But notice what they're going to say to him when they get there in verse 5. And said to him, look, you're old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the other nations. Now, remember what we read in Judges? What was the first thing it said? They didn't have a king. They didn't have a king. So now they're coming to Samuel and they're saying, hey, we don't have a king. And your sons are, you know, they don't follow after your ways, and you're getting old, so you know what we need? We need a king. Why'd they think they needed a king? Why did they need a king? Because they wanted to be like everybody else. I mean, what's the rationale behind all that? Give us a king because that'll be great. He'll be a good leader. No. That's not what they were even saying. Give us a king so we can be like the nations around us. They all got kings. Looks like they're doing okay. Give us a king, Samuel. You're getting old. Your sons are no good. Give us a king. They desired to be like the nations around them. Is that any different today? You know, we read this stuff a long time ago. It's history. You know, that's history. Is that any different than today? Thousands of years ago? Is that any different than today? Is that not the same temptation for us today? All you have to do is look at your kids. We just started school. And what are the kids doing when they come home from school? You know, Jimmy had this pair of shoes, man. They were fantastic. You know what? I want some of those. I want those too. Or Susie or Billy or Bobby or, you know, they've got something that what the kids... We want what they got. Why? Because it seems better. Is that not a temptation for us even? We say the kids, you know, make it look like they're the ones that have that trouble. Wanting to be like their friends and everybody around them. Yeah. Is that a temptation for us today? You know, David talked about why do the wicked prosper? You know, he asked those questions in the Psalms a lot of times. Why do the wicked prosper? You know what? David looked around and he could see people that weren't following God and they were worldly and immoral and man, they looked like they just had it all. Or you think about Solomon in his lifetime. He was a corrupt, immoral person at one point in his life, but he had everything. You know, and David looked around and he saw everything that everybody had and they're wicked and David's thinking, what is going on here? Don't we do the same thing? I mean, I have to watch myself every day that I don't fall into that trap. Why do I have it so bad? I'm trying to serve God. They're not trying to do anything about God. They got everything. What am I doing wrong? I want to be like them. That's what God's people were saying. Samuel, this ain't no good anymore. Give us a king. We want to be like the nations around us. They all got kings and they seem to be doing good. We don't have a king. Where'd they find themselves? When they started looking around and wanting to be like everybody else, where did they find themselves? Where did that lead them? It led them to captivity. You think there's not a lesson there for us? If we're forgetting about God and everything He's done, and we're doing what we think is right in our own eyes, and we want to be like everybody around us, where's that leading us? Well, I know where it led God's people. Led them to captivity. Where's it going to lead us? It's going to lead us to captivity. There was a guy that I remember, first place my dad preached, one of his phrases that he always said was, sure as a world. Yeah. You know where that's going to lead you? Captivity, sure as a world. That's exactly where you're going to go. God's told us all along, from the Old Testament to the New Testament, you know what He wanted about His people? You know how He described His people? In Exodus. Right before they had they got the Ten Commandments, Exodus 19, they had just crossed the Red Sea, and God's talking to Moses, and you know how He described His people? He said, they're a special treasure to Me. They're a kingdom of priests. They're a holy nation. That's the way God described His people back in Exodus. Does that sound familiar? You get into 1 Peter, and Peter tells us we're a chosen generation. We're a royal priesthood. We're His own special people. That's what we're supposed to be. But what's the temptation for us most of the time? We want to be like everybody else. God says, no, you're special. You're holy. You're royal. And what's the temptation for us? We want to be like everybody else. Does that make any sense at all? It doesn't. I mean, it just doesn't. We can't make any sense of that. That's not logical. To think God's going to treat me as something special, His own, but yet I want to be like that. I want to do what they do. That's what God's people did. And God was telling them the exact same thing that He tells us, that He wants us to be His children. He wants us to be special to Him. And what do we choose? We choose to be like everybody else. And what's that going to do? It's going to lead us into captivity. Just like it did God's people. They rejected God as king. They wanted to be like all the other nations around them. What did they say? Give us a king. You know, what was it that if you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 8, you see in verse 6, after the people come to Samuel and say, give us a king. Notice Samuel's reaction to all that in verse 6. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord. Notice in verse 7, and the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. You know, Samuel's distraught. You know, he's even thinking in some ways that, well, they've rejected me. God says, nah, this ain't about you, Samuel. They haven't rejected you. They haven't rejected your message. They've rejected me. You know, when they came to Samuel and they said, give us a king, when you look at the very end of Judges and it says there was no king in Israel, that speaks volumes of God's people and where they were at in their mindset and the way they were living. They didn't have a king. But they wanted one. But they didn't want the right one. They rejected God as the king. And isn't that true? Isn't that true? You remember when Jesus came? What was His claim? He's a king. He's a king. You know how we know that's true? He said He was. You remember the sign they hung up on the cross? What was the description of Jesus there on the cross? Here's Jesus, King of the Jews. And what did Israel, or what did the Jews think about that? He's not our king. What they want, they even wanted that sign taken down. They didn't even like the sign being up there describing Jesus as their king. Yeah. That's how bad they had rejected Him. They couldn't even read it. They didn't even want to see it. What about us? You know, there's a passage that I think about all the time, and it describes this exact thing. When Luke writes to us in Luke 6 and in verse 46, why do you call me Lord, Lord? You know how it goes. Why do you call me Lord, Lord? I think you could even put in the word king if you want to. It's the same idea. The one who has authority, your master, your Lord. Why do you call me king, king? And do not the things that I say. Isn't that us? We claim Jesus is our king. Do we follow Him? Nope. We claim Jesus is our king. Do we look around and want to be like everybody else? Yep. We claim Jesus is our king, but don't we want to do what we want to do? Yeah. We claim Jesus is our king, but don't we forget about everything God's done for us at times? We sure do. We sure do. I'll raise my hand right now and tell you I do. It's a struggle sometimes. God's people rejected Him as their king. What'd that do for them? Captivity. If we reject Jesus as our king, what's that going to do for us? Nothing different. Captivity. You know, when they rejected God as their king, they had to turn to something else. They had to turn to something else. And one of the things that we find, look over in Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7. He's speaking here about some of the relationships. One of the things that God stressed was also the relationships that they had. As they rejected God, they started turning to other nations. They started intermarrying. And that's one of the things that he describes here in Deuteronomy chapter 7. And in verse 3, you shall not make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughters to their son, nor take their daughter for your son. Why? For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. You know, you forget about God and His work. You start doing whatever you want to do. You desire to be like the nations around you. You reject God as king. What's that going to mean? You're going to have to turn to something else. Your allegiance is going to have to be somewhere else. Your trust is going to have to be somewhere else. And God said, you know what's going to happen? You do all those things, what's going to happen? You're going to turn away from me and you're going to turn to other gods. Because there is no other choice. If you reject God, if you turn away from Him, if you don't hold Him up as your king, something else is going to take that place. It could be self, it could be worldly things, but it's going to be something. If God's not holding that position, something or someone else is in your life. Look at 1 Kings chapter 11, just a couple more verses tonight. I appreciate your attention, your patience. 1 Kings chapter 11, we talked a little bit and just mentioned briefly Solomon. Notice what God tells him. We all think about Solomon as the wisest, the wealthiest, you know, one of the great people of the Scriptures. But Solomon had his problems. Notice in verse 1 of 1 Kings chapter 11, "But King Solomon loved many foreign women as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel." Notice this is almost a direct quote from Deuteronomy. "You shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods." And Solomon clung to these in love. "And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not fully follow the Lord, as did his father David. And he even raised up, it says, high places in verse 7, and burnt incense to these gods, or he allowed his wives to burn these incense to these other gods. And in verse 9, so the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice, and had commanded him to concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods, but he did not keep what the Lord had commanded." Notice how many times in 10 verses it talks about what Solomon turned his heart from the Lord. Solomon. The one who, remember when he was younger, asked for wisdom so that he might lead his people and do what's right. And what did he do? He intermarried. He got involved with people of the world that were following other gods. And what happened to him? He did too. He turned from the Lord. The Lord had warned them, if you reject me as king, you'll find another. That's exactly what happened to Solomon. That's exactly what will happen to us. Romans chapter 6. Two more verses. Romans chapter 6. Paul talks about the idea of captivity or bondage. And it's interesting if you notice these verses. Romans chapter 6, starting in verse 16. Paul asks a question here. He says, "Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slave whom you obey, whether it is of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness?" What's Paul telling the Romans here? He's saying, you're captive. You're in bondage. You're a slave. Now you get to choose who you're going to be in captivity or in bondage to. It's either sin or righteousness. But Paul's telling them, guess what? You're in captivity. One way or another, you're in captivity. And why is it that we find ourselves slaves of sin? Captive to sin, in bondage to sin. Because we forget about God and His work. We do what's right in our own eyes. We desire to be like those around us. We reject God as King. We have relationships with the world. And we turn to idols. What did that do for God's people? It put them in captivity. What's it going to do for us? It's going to put us in captivity just as Paul describes here. Notice in verse 17, though, but God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, you were in captivity, you were in bondage, Yet though you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered, and having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. You know, that's the great part about the story. In Ezra, we find God's people in captivity because of all the things we've talked about tonight. But they came out of that captivity. And Paul says, you know what? You're captive. You're in bondage. You're a slave. But guess what? It doesn't have to be that way. You can be set free by following Christ, by following the laws of righteousness. You can be set free. Now, there's a passage that's been mentioned a number of times here recently, and it was my last verses, John 8, 31 and 32, where John says this, you are my disciples indeed. Let me read it. I'm going to try to quote stuff and I'll mess it all up. John 8, if you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. That's what Paul was telling the Romans. That's what Paul is telling us. That we're captive, but we can be set free. I like history. You can learn a lot of things from it. I hope tonight's lesson is something that will get you to think about that. Will help you maybe this week. We got a new week starting. To think about your relationship with God. And are you in captivity? Are you not in a right relationship with God? Well, you know, the bold fact in the matter, if you're in captivity, you know whose fault it is? It's yours. But God is a God of compassion. God is a God of love. God is a God of hope. And He says, if you're in captivity, I can set you free. But that's your choice. So tonight, if there's anyone here
that's captive,
and you know you are, God can set you free. He's done everything possible to set you free by sending His Son. And if you're here tonight and you need that, please let it be known as we stand and as we sing our song.